Major Han, reel 50. I think you were saying that some of the people on the course really didn't have the inclination to do this sort of really hard infantry work.
Oh, well, they probably the stamina. You know, they could do all the infantry work, but these sort of 20-mile dashes really are something out of the ordinary, which not many people do. I mean, schoolboys, they used to hate it, and they had to cross-country run them. I used to find that people who were not used to that sort of thing would struggle. That didn't sort of detract from the fact that they could command and do a good job. I don't think many people were called upon to do a 20-mile bash like we were had to do there. It was something completely out of the ordinary. So it's
just pushing the limits of endurance, isn't it?
But, it wasn't necessary. It's a good thing to test people and make them go to their limits.
What did you think of the infantry tactics? Did you take to those when you were doing that training?
I found it very good, very interesting, but didn't sort of make me want to join up to be an infantryman. I realised then what a tough life the infantry had compared with a person in an armoured car or a tank. I think it's a different type of career altogether.
What about the tank tactics? How did they compare to the auto-armoured car tactics?
Again, they were much different because you didn't have the freedom in a tank troop. You went forward and you had your three armoured cars and you had more or less your set tactics. Certainly as you would with a squadron, but with an armoured car you were more or less a free agent, but with the tanks you couldn't go swanning off wherever you wanted. You had your line that you had good advance to take on the enemy. I remember once I was commanding the troop on a little exercise, and we had Cromwell tanks, and I was coming up from below a ridge. I had a look, ready to go to the next bound. And in the far distance, I saw three Cromwells doing a sort of thing. And I thought, that's the troop that's gone on ahead of us. We've come a bit fast and we've probably caught up with them. So I ignored them, you see. And my word, did I get a dressing down? There was a corporal on the back of mine who was an instructor. And he gave me a dressing down. He said, why didn't you take on those three tanks? I said, I thought they were ours. You know, they were Cromwells. I thought it was the troop that had gone on ahead, so I ignored them. And in the desert, Rommel captured a lot of our equipment and used it against us. They took a lot of American Sherman tanks up from the First Army, used them against us in the Eighth Army. So I said, I'm sorry. I said, that was a mistake. And because the corporal had never been out of England, but I couldn't say anything to him at all. You know, I had to take his criticism and apologise because I'd misread
the situation.
But it was quite funny to have him
lecturing you on the desert.
Not what had happened on the desert. But it was, it could have been an enemy, but as I say, I thought it was the troop ahead. What else did we have to do there?
Did you get any instruction at all in tactics at a higher level, up to squadron level or above?
Only in the classroom. You would have we had a number of 7th Hussar officers who had been in Burma. I think he's done very well. they were very good, and they sort of helped us quite a lot in different.
Did they discuss jungle tactics as well
No,
European?
No, just European.
How did they do this instruction in the higher level? Did they use sand table or just blackboard and chalk?
We had sand table, we also had a blackboard, and we'd either be round sand table with chairs down, a blackboard down, and each person was asked to give his opinion, certainly on the sand table. So it's all. We were. A long time doing this, and because when they suddenly decided that they were going to close the main building and move to Bobbington, and because we happened to be the last, we were about to pass out at Sandhurst, we go up to the old building.
Couple of steps.
Yeah, but no, suddenly we had to then go to Bobbington. The troop ahead of us passed out, and just as we were about to, the thing was closed, and we moved to the building in Bobbington, which laid us for nearly another month passing out. But by the time we got there, settled in, and started preparing again for the passing out parade, I think we were, and of course Christmas came in between. So I think we were another month set back, hadn't been set back before. If we had not been set back with the HAC company troop, we would have passed out in time. All this sort of stuff.
So you were delayed again. How long were you in training then for officer training overall, including the delays?
Well, we started in March. Sometime, I don't know if it was in March, I might be able to find this out. And we passed out on the 5th of January.
So you were...
9 months?
Well, more, isn't it?
Yeah, enough 9 months.
Yes.
March. June,
December.
Yeah.
January.
5th of January.
Yeah. So...
It's only 10 months.
Ten months of actual training, and then... And in the meantime, there have been some rather momentous events going on. There was the... Do you remember hearing about the use of atomic bombs on Japan?
Yes, that came into it when we were at Oktu. See, so that changed, I think, a lot of thoughts.
In what way? Well, do you remember what your immediate reaction was when you heard that news?
My immediate reaction was, thank God, the war's over in Japan. And my one thought was that my brother would be home, and thought, well, what a tremendous saving of life it's going to be from the forces if they had knowing how the Japanese had fought for every bit of land they had, and it would have cost a lot of lives if we had invaded Japan or wherever, and so that was. The big relief, I think. But then that was the time, I think, when a lot of people were having second thoughts about staying in the army.
Yeah. What about your thoughts? Were you intent on staying in?
Oh, having gone so far, I wasn't going to to throw it all away. And also, I loved the army. It'd been my life, really. So I didn't know what the future was going to be, but I suppose it's time, because there's no job for me, so I might as well
stay in.
Mm. And when we got down to Bobbington, we had RSM Britain was our man for the passing out parades. And then, I think we must have got there in November or early December. And a great friend of mine was Peter Desjardins. He was a Canadian. He'd been with the Canadian Guards. And I was best man at his wedding November, I think, in November, early December time. And I still keep in touch with him. He became paymaster of the Canadian forces in Germany. And then he went on to become, joined the Treasury in Canada, and was their top man on the finance with NATO. So he did very well.
Built a nice career.
He did. Yeah, he was a charming man. He comes and sees me quite often.
When you moved from the pre-Octia to the Octia, did this make a significant difference in your living conditions and social arrangements?
Not really. The accommodation is very good. Although we weren't living in little rooms with two of the room, we had a barrack room with probably about 12 people in at Wellington. But we were all in the same troop, so you know, we all come on here.
What about when you were in the old building? Did you have a room there?
I think we shared a room with one other person. We had, I think about two to a room, might have been more. And we also had a servant who used to look after us and clean our kit and that sort of thing.
What sort of man was he?
He was an old soldier, he'd been there for years and years. He's still there.
How did you get on with him?
They were very, they looked on us as young boys, you know, sort of, and they were the old soldiers, and they sort of more or less tell you what's what. You know, they weren't servants as much, but they would suffer us, I think. But they used to keep us kit clean or help clean the kit. They weren't too bad. But we didn't get that when we got to Bovington.
It was different to Bovington.
You had to look after yourself.
What about feeding arrangements in the old building?
They were very good. We had the big dining room, and the food was good. And we used to have, I'm not sure it was about once a month, we'd have a dinner night when the whole of the staff would be there. And it'd be like a regimental dinner night, which would just be quite impressive. I think those, you know, we had wine then, I think we probably did. But it was a nice special meal as well. So,
did you have access to a bar on a normal basis? Anteroom facilities or anything like that?
I remember. Quite honestly, I wasn't a drinking man. I don't think many of us were drinking. We didn't have time. We couldn't really afford to drink because we had commitments to keep fit. Anyway, I know we used to have a naffy down, that's sort of like in a cellar, I think. And we always used to be there, I think, around about 10 in the morning for a nice coffee, good coffee. And cakes or sausages in bread roll at a reasonable price, and that was a regular routine. But on the whole, I think the food was good, but also we were then still on ration, so there was no you could buy a certain number of sweets or whatever, but only on your ration coupon.
Were you allowed out at all when you were in the Octia?
Oh yes. There was no restriction on that if you had the time and somewhere to go. But I think mostly people were stayed at home and either read up on whatever they had to do, wrote up their notes and that. And by that time, they're ready for bed anyway. There was no late night things.
Was there a lot of reading to do?
I think there was.
What sort of things?
Well, depending on what side of the course you were at the stage, and you would have to brush up to make sure you were well up to it. So you had your map reading, and certainly there were certain lectures, and so you'd try to keep up on current affairs in case on the particular lecture you were asked to give any opinion. So you were kept pretty busy the whole time, and there's no sort of late night sort of parties or anything like that. Although you were allowed at the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, you were normally free, except when there was a church parade. Then Sunday, of course, you couldn't get away. So you could get off at a weekend, and the train service up to London was quite good.
How often did you have the church parades?
I think they were once a month. I think it was about once a month. And I don't say that everybody then had to attend. I think you had to certain squads or troops were say right there on the plane. I don't think they would have the whole
intake.
No, I don't think so. And of course this when we went to Bowington, it seemed to be a different thing. I think it lost a lot of the magic. And fortunately, we were only there for a short time before we passed out. Say we passed out in the January.
Did you have a grand parade at Bowington?
Yes, it was the same parade, and you still had to march up the steps. So it was, they carried on the same tradition.
But in a different building.
In a different building, yeah, which I think was a bit of a disappointment to us. And the parade was taken by Colonel Norman, who was a 9th Lancer. He commanded the 9th, and his son was in our intake. And he took the passing out parade.
How soon before passing out did you know which regiment you were going into?
Well, you could have chosen your regiment. Oh, when we were in, well, 2 or 3 months before. And I was rather stupid, really, because the war was over, and I thought to go back to the 12th Lancers from being another rank into the mess would be difficult for me. A, because the 12th Lancers were a very rich regiment, and I thought I wouldn't be able to cope.
Couldn't afford the.
I couldn't really afford it. You know, and so I didn't opt to go to the regiment. I could have done, and I was told afterwards, after I'd been commissioned, how stupid I was and how ridiculous my argument was for not going back to the regiment. Had I been commissioned in the field, I think it would have been different altogether. But to go and knowing how the regiment lived in peacetime, where every man was wealthy, I thought I wouldn't be able to cope. So I asked to join the East African Armoured Car Regiment, which was commanded by Colonel Byrne, who had commanded our regiment. And I knew that sort of thing would get me into a good stream anyway. And I thought, well, that's a job I could do and would love to do. So that was all right. I was going, so I was commissioned into the RAC.
Royal Armoured Corps.
That's right. And after I was commissioned, had leave, and now I was on my way out to join the East African Armoured Car Regiment.
Where were they based at that time?
Probably would have been Nairobi or somewhere. I think it was somewhere there. And so I was quite keen on this. And I knew it was a job I could do. And I knew expenses I could cope with on in a place like that anyway. And I was on my way out to East Africa, and got to Cairo, and stayed there for about a fortnight and all had to go. And so the HQ, Middle East, said, hey, you're not going there. We want officers like you in the British Army out here. Well, not out here, but in Italy. There's the Fort Hussars. That's where you're going. So off I went from Cairo and joined the Fort Hussars, which was up in near the farm chest anyway.
How did the 4th Hussars as a regiment compare to the 12th Lancers?
In what way?
Well, in every way, you know, in the atmosphere in the regiment, the way they worked and so on.
They were a great regiment. They were a very good regiment. And charming officers. Still all very rich officers. But that's where I found how stupid I'd been not to join the 12th in the first place. Because, as I say, I had no money, but it made no difference to them. I fitted in well, they treated me well, and apart from sort of spending money on racing and having a racehorse or polo pony and that sort of thing, which I could get away with anyway, I mean, life was fantastic. And they were really charming, charming people. They were tanks then, the 4th Hussars. And they had one armoured car troop in the regiment.
That would be the regimental recce, presumably.
That's right. And I had a troop of armoured cars. They were Greyhounds. And I was made troop leader of that, which suited me down to
the So you were fitted into exactly the right slot.
That's right. And as I say, the commanding officer was Colonel Smith. We had Major Eve, Stephen Eve, who had been taken prisoner in Greece with the 4th. There was Lupi Kennard. He's written the book. I know if you read it, Lupi. He was A Squadron, 4th Hussars, again, was taken prisoner in Greece. And all the officers were great. So I joined A Squadron, and that was the squadron with the armoured cars. John Storson, Major General Storson, he was a captain, and he used to push all his work onto me. And I was given the job of regimental messing officer. I had my troop of armoured cars, which I used to take out every day on training, and trained every man in the troop to do the other man's job, drive, become a radio operator. And I used to leave about 7 in the morning, get back about 5 at night, on troop training, just with the troop. And that was a full-time job. I was also a regimental boxing officer, regimental cross-country running officer. And in the squadron, we had our own PRI shop, rather, you know, with, we used to sell stuff in the PRI, which John Storton should have been running, but he said, right, you can do that.
So what sort of things did the shop sell?
Like they do now in a regimental, you know, anything regimental gear, or there might be odd sort of glasses and any mementos and all that sort of thing. And then they used to sell stuff like goodies, chocolate bars and all that.
Like a fancy good shop.
It was. And also like a little nappy type thing, you see. So I had to run that as well and keep the accounts. And I was really up to my neck in work there. And one day I know something went wrong with the messing, because I had money that I could buy stuff for the messing to supplement the rations. And I know one day the meal was terrible, and there was complaints to all the officer. And I was out of the barracks with the thing, so it got to the colonel, and he sent for me, and I apologise. I know it's probably my fault. I haven't sort of spent the time to, you know, check the menu or whatever. And he said, it's not your fault. He said, they're flogging a willing horse. You know, you've got this, 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 and this. You know, straight away, the colonel said, right, hand over the messing to someone else. Hand over, don't have anything to do with the squadron shop or anything. John Storton's job. You know, you can still do the boxing and you still do the cross country run, and you've got your troop, which I'm very well pleased with. So that was it. But they did, and even, you know, I'm not used to volunteer, but yes, I'll do it. Don't worry, you know. Like,
the new boy gets landed with.
That's right.
It's rather like what happened to you when you first arrived in the army, wasn't it? When you were asked if you wanted all the kit you'd been issued.
That's right, yeah.
You were caught out.
And, you know, they thought they'd probably got a sucker here. But, I mean, I've always been the same. I've always been willing to do things for somebody. Yeah. And, like, somebody up once or twice went, well, can you lend me some money? Yeah, here you are. And I'd lend it to him. I never got back. And my wife said to me, you'll never change. She would say, don't do it, you know. But it's the same after when I went in partnership. Just the same. Yeah, I'm a sucker for that.
Too trusting.
Well, it is. I trust people. If I say something, I mean it. I wouldn't say anything unless I really meant it. And I assume that everybody else is the same. You know, I wouldn't do anyone down. And if I can help anyone, I always will. And I always expect people will do the same for me, but it's not so. I'm sorry to say, it's a cruel world.
How long were you overloaded then before you got shot of these surplus duties? How long did this go on for?
2 or 3 months.
2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
And did you find, you know, within every regiment has its own particular customs and ways of doing things. I mean, did the 4th Hussars differ in any material way from the way in which the 12th Lancers did?
Not really. They still had the same pursuits. They were all red hot on racing. There was a racing race course.
Aiello.
And we had a racehorse in the regiment called Colonel Warden, which was the name used by Churchill when he went out on.
That's right, cover name.
And we had this racehorse, and that used to scoop the board. But that was one of the main things. And we had a tremendous stable. Lots of German horses we acquired. And we had a big stable with 5 or 6 grooms. And the other thing I used to do too, I used to run the drag.
The drag hunt?
Yeah. And I used to do the whole thing on my own. They had a fox in a cage and I had a sack in it, you see. And I'd go the night before with the colonel and walk the course, pick all the jumps, and I used to do about 8 or 9 miles. And I used to do that on my own. And I'd start off with the sack, and I'd drag it, and go all around the course, find a river that I could go across, and the field, which would be about 50 riders, General Harding, all the generals, and all the officers and the cavalry regiments around used to be there. And as I say, I used to walk the course the night before, and then halfway round the course, there'd be a bottle of this stuff from the fox, and I'd pour that on the sack to refresh it, and off I'd go again. And as I say, I used to run 9 miles, and I could do it, because I used to
Very fit.
And I used to give them some tremendous ride because I used to pick all the good stone walls, you know, the night before. And and so that was one of the other things I used to do. Almost once a week I used to do this, in addition to all my other things. And of course they all used to appreciate it, and used to be, as far as I was concerned, it was good fun. And except one day, I said to the what's his name, the chappie who was the they used to call him the huntsman, I suppose. I said to him, "Give me 20 minutes start. before you come, and all these horses were all lined up. And now the big field, I think about 500 yards, which I had to cross, and then I'd sort of start on my